ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The economy has hit a wall. Consumer spending is in decline as household income plummets. And if it wasn't for population growth, economists say Australia would be in a recession.
Per person in the economy, growth is actually going backwards. Now, that's what actually matters for living standards.
You don't need to be paying that much attention to be aware that economic growth matters. Growth is central to economics, and the growth of the last 60 years or so has delivered not just prosperity, but the important things it brings, chiefly health and education. But the pursuit of growth has had consequences, and it's that tension that we're going to explore this time on The Money. Hello, I'm Richard Aidy, and in a moment you'll meet Daniel Suskind. He's a research professor in economics at King's College London. He also has a position at the Institute for Ethics in Artificial Intelligence at Oxford University. And he's the author of Growth, A Reckoning. Daniel, welcome to The Money. What got you started on this?
I think there are a few things that politicians agree upon today from different corners of the political spectrum. But one of them is that we need more economic growth. So, you know, in the UK, worklessness and poverty are rising, public services are backlogged and broken, average real wages, which are the best measure of our collective prosperity, haven't really risen here for 15 years. You know, there's a real feeling that we desperately need more growth. So that was part of it. The other part is that the problem isn't as simple as that, because on the other hand, when you look at the great challenges that we face, whether it's climate change, whether it's growing inequalities in society, whether it's the disruption of work and politics by technologies like artificial intelligence, which has been my traditional interest, or the sort of desolation of local places and communities, what you see is that growth is often in the driving seat for those challenges as well. So there's this extraordinary tension between, on the one hand, desperately wanting more growth, and on the other hand, feeling like we want less growth.
Well, I mean, in response to this tension, and particularly the kind of litany of problems you just briefly unfurled for us, there's been two arguments. The first, and it's been canvassed on this show more than once, is that we should change what we measure and how we measure it. So either abandoning the GDP as a metric, or making it one of a suite of metrics that will sit in a dashboard that also captures things like well-being and carbon emissions in the environment. Firstly, what do you make of that approach?
In short, I'm quite dismissive of that approach. I think the temptation to treat these questions as if they're just questions of mismeasurement, as if we can, you know, find the right things to measure and bundle them all together into a sort of more perfect GDP measure, I think that's likely to run aground. The argument I make in the book is that, look, this isn't really a technical question of measurement, but it's really a moral question of what matters. And if we're dealing with moral questions about how much we ought to prioritize growth versus other things that we might care about, whether it's the health of the environment, the level of, you know, economic division in society, and so on and so on, the answers to those questions aren't going to be found by technocrats and bureaucrats working in, you know, central government statistical offices trying to come up with new measures. They're the sorts of questions that we have to put back to citizens. And we need a new wave of, you know, political innovation to support that kind of deliberation among citizens.
And I want to get to that. But before we do, the other approach to the problems with growth is very much a moral one, and that's degrowth. So Greta Thunberg is probably its most well-known proponent. Yep. What about that?
And it's an interesting idea. You know, it's not simply that we ought to press pause on growth, but that we actually ought to go into reverse, that we ought to pursue negative GDP growth. It's an idea that began among a small group of relatively obscure academics a few decades ago, but it's now become more and more popular. So you're exactly right. You know, Greta Thunberg's a supporter, but so is David Attenborough, the voice of nature. So are politicians in the UK like Caroline Lucas. It's an idea that I think we have to take seriously. And on the one hand, I think they get something right, something really important right, which is that something has to give. We cannot continue to grow in the way that we are. you know, if anything, I think the degrowth movement probably underestimate the cost of growth because their focus tends to be on the environmental costs of growth. But the costs aren't just environmental. You know, there's a whole variety of costs to growth. And, you know, some of the ones I've mentioned before, inequality, technologies like AI, disrupting work and politics, and so on and so on. So they probably underestimate the costs of growth. I think they're right to focus on those costs. Where I think they're wrong is this idea that in response, we ought to press pause on growth or even go into reverse. I mean, my view is that if we were to really do that, it would be one of the greatest acts of self-harm that humankind could inflict on itself. It would just be such a catastrophe. So let's imagine that we freeze global GDP per head at current levels. That would mean in practice leaving 800 million people in extreme poverty. Or, you know, if you find that unacceptable, it would mean slashing the income of the 7.1 billion people that remain in the developed world. It just seems so unimaginative of the degrowth movement to think that our current lot is the best that we could ever do, that we've reached some kind of economic peak, and that all that's left for us is to simply sort of cut up and redistribute what we've currently created.
The thing that I kept thinking was this is just so fundamentally against human nature, which is why I think it's not a starter. And I want to get to what you propose. But before we do, we kind of have to go back a bit because growth turns out to be kind of weird that for most of history, we didn't have it, or we only had it so sporadically that it then vanished. And yet, what, 200 years ago, a bit over 200 years ago, that changes. So what happened?
Yeah, you're exactly right. For 300,000 years, human life was essentially stagnant. You know, whether you were a hunter-gatherer in the Stone Age or a laborer working away in the 18th century at the start of the Industrial Revolution, though your lives would have differed in lots of different respects, fundamentally, from an economic point of view, they would have been very similar. You know, you would have just been stuck in an ongoing struggle for subsistence. And that only changed very, very recently, you know, about 200 years ago. So economic growth as a sort of process is extremely new in the grand scheme of things. It's even newer, though, as a political priority. Now, we live in societies today that really prioritize growth, and our sort of collective success is determined by basically how much stuff we're able to produce, whether GDP is going up or down. Mm. Yeah, politicians' fates fall on that number.
When we say that there will be a bigger emphasis on growth in this budget, we mean it. But we also mean sustainable growth. Think of it as protein, not just carbs. By this, I mean a bigger emphasis on the foundations of growth and the drivers of growth. That's what the budget will be all about.
But what's really interesting is that if you go back to the 1950s, very few politicians, policymakers, economists, anyone is talking about economic growth at all. The idea that we might pursue economic growth, you know, directly as a sort of objective of economic policy, although it's, you know, completely fundamental today, it just didn't exist 70 years ago.
Yes, there was a movement to firstly pursue growth and then to prioritize it and then for it to become a kind of panacea so that governments and politicians didn't have to engage with lots of questions because growth was going to mean that everything was going to be all right.
That's right. I mean, it's captured really nicely by that well-known line from President John F. Kennedy, a rising tide lifts all boats. Mm. There was a sense that growth was a sort of a rare, yeah, exactly as you say, a sort of panacea, that it promised in different ways to benefit everyone. And it's important not to be too dismissive of that idea, because it's true that in the 20th century, you know, growth does appear to be associated with almost every measure of human flourishing that we can come up with. You know, it lifts billions of people out of poverty, but not only that, you know, richer economies tend to have, you know, better healthcare systems, better education systems. You know, almost any measure of human success that we can conceive of appears to have economic growth behind it, driving it along.
Mm. I was struck by the fact that my entire life has been in this sort of post-growth phase, and I'm definitely taller and healthier than my ancestors were because of what growth brought. Okay, if you've just joined us, I'm talking to Daniel Susskind, who's the author of Growth, A Reckoning, which is a kind of unpacking of what economic growth is, how weird it's been if you look at the totality of human existence and what the problems with it are. We've touched, Daniel, on, I suppose, two of the approaches of trying to deal with those problems, one of which is to kind of have a think about how we measure what we measure. The other is to abandon the idea of growth altogether. Now, you reject both of them. You actually want more growth.
And that's the starting point. That has to be the starting point, which is that to abandon this process of economic growth would just be a tragedy for all the reasons that we've spoken about. If we want to achieve our most basic priorities for society, providing a good level of material comfort for everyone, providing good access to education and healthcare, we need more growth and we need the prosperity that comes with that growth. I think here, that sort of view rubs up a little against the view that we were discussing before of the degrowth movement. I mean, one of the interesting things about that movement is that they have a slogan which has become very popular, not only in their movement, but more widely, which is this idea that you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. You know, we live on a finite planet. We only have so many resources that are available to us, and that, you know, that means that there's some sort of physical limit to the amount that we can grow. And I think one of the most important arguments of the book is that that claim is wrong, that we can have infinite growth or effectively infinite growth on a finite planet. And the belief that we can't, it seems to me, is based on a misunderstanding of how economic growth actually works. And that's another big sort of theme of the book, is trying to really understand, you know, how is it that economic growth works?
Well, let's talk about that. Because, and there's a lot to get through and I'm conscious of time. But basically, what you're talking about is ideas, the power of ideas, and then the determined pursuit of things using and harnessing those ideas.
That's right. So there is a sort of a view, an old-fashioned view of economic growth. The economic growth comes from the material world. It comes from using more and more finite resources, more land, more fuel.
More people. Cobalt, more lithium these days.
Exactly. And it's important just to step back. What causes economic growth, you know, despite the sort of confidence of our politicians and policymakers, the way they talk about growth today, it's actually a bit of a mystery. We know far less, I think, than many people assume about the causes of economic growth. And you know, tracing that, you know, this sort of extraordinary mystery, incredibly important process sitting at the center of our lives, we actually know surprisingly little about it. But nevertheless, I do think there is one lesson, and it's this lesson, which is that economic growth doesn't come from using more and more finite resources. It comes from discovering ever more productive ways to use those resources. In other words, as you say, it comes from discovering new ideas about the world that allow us to make more productive use of the resources that we have. And so the key point here is that whereas it's true that the world of finite resource, the world of sort of physical resources that we can see and touch is finite, the world of ideas is unimaginably vast, you know, for all practical purposes, as good as infinite. Just a practical example, if you imagine a kitchen larder at home with 300 ingredients in it, you know, so a well-stocked larder, that's a finite set of resources. And yet there are more possible recipes, more possible ideas for combining those resources than there are atoms in the universe.
Yes. And it's this
point, which is that if, you know, growth comes from discovering ideas, new ideas, ideas about how to use our resources, the universe of all those possible ideas is just unimaginably vast. It's just so it's so wrong to think that growth is constrained by finite resources, because that just isn't where growth comes from. It comes from those ideas.
Let's talk about how, I suppose, to get more of them and harness them better.
Yes.
And you identify some issues here.
Yes.
And one of them's, you want us to change how we think about intellectual property, IP. I think this is really hard, actually. There are many, many extremely well-resourced corporations and entire sectors and industries with a vested interest in the IP approach that we have now. Why is it so important that we change it, and how could we do it?
I mean, intellectual property is a sort of disarmingly dry term for, I think, one of the most important, you know, levers that we have for thinking about how we might create more ideas, because it involves the sort of questions of who gets to own and control those ideas, you know, who has a right to use and reuse them. And in the book, I trace out what I think are lots of problems with the intellectual property regime. Just one example, just to really, I think, hammer the point home. Around the world, one of the central sort of international agreements which govern copyright law in different countries is known as the Berne Convention. And this convention, which governs copyright, hasn't been revised since 1971. So the last time this international agreement was revised was not simply a time for the internet, not simply a time before personal computers became widespread, but it was a time before even personal electronics, the idea of personal electronics, was invented. The first Walkman hadn't yet been invented. So we have sitting at the center of our international agreements with respect to copyright, this agreement, which was just conceived in a completely different technological environment. And you see that sort of thing again and again.
You see choke points, don't you? And in fact, we've talked about choke points on the show. Well, not you and I, but we have done it on the money. I also want to ask you about, because one of the things that IP is associated with is research and development. IP and R&D. There we go. All the acronyms.
Yes. Yes.
But you actually, this is something you want to see a great deal more of. More R&D, more people doing it, more money being poured into it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we cannot expect a steady stream of new ideas about the world unless we invest heavily in their discovery. And the trends in R&D globally are really uninspiring. So in the UK, they've been falling precipitously. In the US, they've been stagnant since the 1960s. But what's even more disarming, more alarming, is when you look at the actual levels of R&D. So the leading country from an R&D point of view is Israel, which invests about 5.4% of its GDP a year in research and development. The average OECD country manages barely half of that. And then, you know, in the UK, we manage barely a third of that. As I said, you know, we cannot expect a steady stream of ideas about how to use our resources more effectively and productively if we don't invest in their discovery. But what's then very interesting is that when you take a country like Israel, which is, you know, right at the forefront in terms of countries investing in R&D, and compare what Israel invests as a percentage of GDP in R&D to what leading technology companies invest as a percentage of their revenue, all of a sudden, those investments by Israel start to look really meager.
You know,
the large technology companies, Alphabet, Facebook, Huawei, Amazon, are investing, you know, 15% or more of their revenue, annual revenue, in research and development. That's the kind of proportion that it seems to me reflects a serious commitment to research and development. So we're just not investing anywhere nearly enough in that process.
And the aim is something called directed technological change. Now,
yes,
I had not encountered the phrase before. Give me the very brief guide to what that is.
Yeah. Well, the starting point is that, you know, if we were to simply pursue more growth, then that would be to make the same mistakes as the past. What we've got to try and do is not only pursue more growth, as we've been talking about, but also change the nature of the growth that takes place. And the way we do that is by changing the nature of the technological progress that takes place. You know, another way to think about what we've been talking about, this idea of finding, you know, new ideas for making more productive use of our finite resources, that's essentially a long-winded way of saying technological progress. And this idea of directed technological progress, it's a relatively it's an idea that has a sort of a history in economic thought, but it's become quite popular recently, and I think for good reason, which is this idea that, you know, technological progress isn't out of our hands. It has a direction, and we can shape that direction if we want to. So a good example of this is what's happened in the environmental sector over the last 20 or so years. You know, if you take the Stern Review back in 2007, which was a landmark report, written by Sir Nicholas Stern in the UK, it was the first report of its kind into the sort of economics of climate change. And one of the central conclusions of that report was that it would cost us 1% of GDP to reduce emissions by 80%. Nicholas Stern then came out the next year and said, no, I got it wrong. Actually, it's going to cost us 2% of GDP to reduce emissions by 80%. In other words, climate change had got worse. What's very interesting, though, is if you look at the sort of expert consensus now, you know, almost more than 15 years later, the estimates are that it would cost us to reduce emissions completely, it would cost us just 0.5% of GDP. In other words, the cost of reducing emissions has fallen really quite dramatically. And so the question is, why? What has happened in the last 15 years? And the answer is that it's not simply that there's been extraordinary technological progress in the last 15 years, but there's been a very particular type of technological progress. There's been a sort of green technological progress.
With renewables, solar power, all sorts of things.
And solar power is the great example, right? So this is a technology that begins in the 1970s as a real tool of last resort, you know, for isolated lighthouses, for outer space. And yet today it's completely commonplace. Why is it commonplace? It's commonplace because, you know, the cost of generating a watt of electricity through solar has fallen about 200-fold. And the key thing is that this technological change happened because of 15 years of changes to taxes and subsidies, to laws and regulations, to social norms around climate. And so technological progress was nudged from a sort of dirty direction, where these technologies that promoted growth also destroyed the environment, to a far greener direction where, you know, we're able to grow without causing as much damage to the environment. And it means that many countries around the world have been able to increase their GDP while also reducing emissions in absolute terms. And that's the sort of thing that was unimaginable 15 years ago.
One of the things that I kept waiting for the book to tell me the economic solutions to this. And ultimately what you land is political solutions. And
yes.
And it's interesting because it's about giving power back to the people and assuming, I have to say, that they're interested in using it.
That's right. It seems to me that these questions about growth, about climate change, about inequality, about technologies like artificial intelligence disrupting work and politics are political questions. They're questions about what sorts of societies we all want to live in. And where the book ends up is arguing that, as I said before, you know, these are not questions that can be answered by technocrats and bureaucrats and economists by fiddling around with the way we measure progress, but they have to be put back to citizens to debate and argue over. And I take a lot of encouragement from the rise in so-called mini publics around the world, things like citizens' assemblies, citizens' juries, citizens' panels, where citizens are called together to debate and discuss very difficult, in fact, in some cases, the most difficult policy questions. And so, you know, these citizen assemblies have been used in Ireland to discuss abortion. They've been used in France to discuss euthanasia. They've been used in Korea to discuss energy policy in the aftermath of the sort of the disasters that have happened in Asia with respect to energy. And it seems to me that these questions about what do we care about if we don't care about growth, and how much do we care about those things? Those are the sorts of questions that have to be put back to citizens through these sorts of participative institutions. And in the book, I set out, you know, how we might go about doing that, how we might go about setting up those arrangements.
You're optimistic about the capability of mini publics. Indeed, of about human nature to want to do it. But the whole thing actually is fundamentally It's framed optimistically, this book, which is interesting because so much of public discourse around growth is not optimistic at all.
That's right. You know, we live in an age of anxiety where it seems like every day we are reminded of the sorts of existential risks that we face under our, you know, supposed incapacity for dealing with them. But the argument of the book is exactly as you say, it's fundamentally an optimistic one, that we have an existential opportunity in front of us, that what this growth dilemma presents us with is an opportunity to pay, you know, far more attention to other valuable things that we might care about in society, which have, you know, over the last 50 years been displaced or ignored by our relentless pursuit of growth. And we can pay attention to these things from a position of strength, you know, looking into the future far more prosperous and technologically capable than ever before in our 300,000 year history. There's a wonderful quotation by the great philosopher Derek Parfit, where he talks about how, you know, we have the power not only to make life good in decades to come, but to make it better in ways that we now cannot even imagine. And it seems to me that nothing could be more important than that. And that really is what the book is all about.
Yeah, although it's not long-termism, which is something else we've talked about on the show. It's not thousands of years into the future or a million years into the future or anything like that. It is more, this is the horizon. We can't see over it, but we've got to address things now and think about the next decades.
Yeah, it's not long-termism. And I, in the book, I throw, you know, argumentative cold water over the idea of long-termism. I don't think it is reasonable to expect people today to be essentially mugged by the demands of trillions of people who are yet to be born. I think, you know, I do think we live in societies that are excessively short-termist, and I write about this in the book, what that means in practice. But I don't think that means we necessarily ought to throw our focus into the extremely distant future. And I think there is a sensible middle ground.
More growth, powered by directed technological change, and of course, only made possible by having, I suppose, moral questions considered by ordinary people.
That's right. And that is where the optimism comes from. It comes from a realization that people often talk about technological progress as if we're on a train and the sort of the rails are set down and all that's left for us to do is kind of trundle along the rails in the sort of predetermined direction that has been set for us. And, you know, we can choose to go faster, we can choose to go slower, but fundamentally the direction has been set. And I think that analogy is the wrong way to think about it. I think it's far more useful to think not of a train, but of a boat, that, you know, we can choose both our speed, but also our direction of travel as well. And we can do this by changing the sorts of technological progress that takes place in society.
Daniel, it's a really, really interesting book, and it's been very interesting to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining me on The Money.
Not at all. Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Daniel Suskind is the author of Growth, A Reckoning. And that's it for now. The Money comes to you from Gadigal Land, Sydney. It's produced by Whitney Fitzsimmons. Our sound engineer is Simon Branthwaite. I'm Richard Aidy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.